From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Academy Awards are Sunday night, and we'll hear from Todd Phillips, director and co-writer of the film Joker, nominated for Best Film, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay. The movie's an origin story of sorts for the villain in the Batman series, but it is not a comic book movie. Also, our interview with actor Kirk Douglas, who died Wednesday at the age of 103. He appeared in more than 70 films and earned 3 Oscar nominations for Best Actor.
I love to play parts or try to find parts with different dimensions. You see, Terry, if I play a strong man in a film, I look for the moments where he's weak. And if I play a weak character, I look for the moments where he's strong, because that's what drama is all about.
Also, Justin Chang reviews the new Russian film Beanpole.
Is it just me, or is it getting crazier out there?
The city is going crazy, and the main character is increasingly unhinged in the movie Joker, which won 2 Golden Globe Awards and is nominated for 11 Academy Awards, including Best Film, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay. Joaquin Phoenix is nominated for Best Actor for his performance in the starring role. Joker was produced, directed, and co-written by our guest Todd Phillips, who also directed the Hangover films. Joker is an origin story of sorts for the villain in the Batman comics and movies. It's set in Gotham City in 1981, which looks very much like Manhattan in 1981. But the movie isn't a comic book story. The main character, Arthur Fleck, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is a man with a history of serious mental health problems. An aspiring comic who works as a clown at parties, he's attacked by 3 men on the subway while he's wearing a costume and makeup. He's carrying a fellow clown's gun, and he shoots and kills his 3 attackers. The incident makes Fleck a folk hero in the crime-ridden city, and people start wearing clown masks in tribute to him. Meanwhile, social service cuts have left him without public assistance, and he's forced off his medications. The deterioration of the city and Arthur's mental health feed off each other in a disastrous way. Terry spoke to Todd Phillips in January.
Todd Phillips, welcome back to Fresh Air. Joker has really divided audiences and critics, but it's done fantastically at the box office. I'm one of the people who thinks this is a terrific film and a very serious film. You said that you made the character Joker in order to make a serious movie that's kind of about a comic book character so you could get a big budget. It was you said, a way to sneak a real movie into the studio system under the guise of a comic book film. Tell us more about that.
I started to think that the films that I grew up loving, that how hard it is to get those movies made nowadays. And I started looking around at the state of the movie business about what people are showing up to. Clearly, you know, superhero films have taken over. So it really started as an experiment, so to speak, is like, well, you know, maybe you could get one of those kind of deep dive character study movies done nowadays in the studio system if you, I guess, disguise it as a comic book film. Not that it was a trick we were playing. It was just something of, boy, you know, you could do a character study if it was about one of those characters.
Let's talk about your vision of Joker, the character of Arthur. He initially paints his face like a clown because he's employed by an agency that basically rents out clowns, right. Like for your child's party or for, like, yeah, the hospital children's ward. But for reasons I won't explain, I don't want to give away too much stuff. You know, he loses his job, but he continues sometimes to paint his face. And he has serious mental health problems. There's a history of mental health problems in his family. And he's soon off his meds because he can no longer afford them. And the city can no longer help him because they're shutting down social services. And his mental health deteriorates as the movie goes on. Why did you want this Joker to have a mental health disorder? And
well,
is it a specific disorder that you've given him?
Well, it wasn't that we wanted him to necessarily have a mental health disorder. What really we wanted to do, and what really the whole MO of the film was, let's make a comic book film where we run everything through as realistic a lens as possible. So why does Joker have a white face and green hair? Well, in the comic books, he fell into a vat of acid. That didn't feel very real to us. If you fell into a vat of acid, I don't know that your skin would turn white and your hair would be green. So we sort of backwards engineered everything. The mental illness was also a thing of going, well, a little bit like, where does his laugh come from? And if you see the movie, you realize he has a condition. Joke, you know, the Joker character in the comic book world is famous for the green hair, the white face, the laugh. So we really just wanted to give everything real-world reasons.
So the deteriorating mental health gives...
Well, that was... Okay, so, you know, that's a different question, two parts. The first thing is we didn't ever really discuss specifically with Joaquin. When I say we, again, me and Joaquin didn't really discuss what... We didn't want to put a specific label on what his mental illness is outside of his affliction that gives him the laugh, which is something that's called caused from... head trauma early on in life, which is a real thing. You know, nowadays it's called PBA, pseudobulbar effect. But back then, I don't know that they even had that name for it. But it's a real condition. So we thought once we found that condition, you know, okay, that answers that. As far as the mental health thing, you know, we really wanted to make a movie that says something, a statement, if you will, on these modern times. Yes, it takes place in 1981 in a fictional city of Gotham, but we wrote it in 2017 in New York City. And oftentimes, you know, movies are mirrors and they reflect what's going on whenever they take place. And that was something Scott and I really was important to us, that we are addressing things that we feel or felt were going on in the world in 2016 and 17 as we were writing it. You know, we all know the big changes in this country that were happening then. I can tell you, when Obama was president, we wrote three Hangover movies. when everything changed, suddenly things felt darker. You know. Anyway, so the mental illness to us was a lot about, you know, what you hear about when social services get cut, what happens to these people. We really thought it was important to shine a light on the system. You know, I think, like a lot of people, the system's broken, and why not use a film to make a comment on that?
You've said that there are a lot of films and filmmakers who were influential on you in the making of Joker, but I think the one that really stands out the most is Scorsese, in terms of, in part, how the film looks. You know, you've got De Niro in the movie, and he was in Taxi Driver and King of Comedy. There are some shots and some things that are so reminiscent of shots in Taxi Driver. And even there's two times, like at the end of Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle puts his finger to his forehead as if the finger is a gun. And then with his thumb, he kind of pulls the trigger of this, you know, imaginary gun. So another, like, Scorsese reference is the fact that there's a late night Tonight Show kind of variety show that's Arthur's mother's favorite show. And Arthur's grown up watching it, and he loves it too. They watch it every night together. And in King of Comedy, Scorsese's film, De Niro is the obsessive fan of the late night show, which in that movie is hosted by someone who played by Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
And De Niro kidnaps the Jerry Lewis character.
Yeah.
And De Niro's goal is to, like, be on that show himself. And in Joker, the Joker character gets on that late night show that De Niro hosts for very misguided reasons on the host's part. So I just wanted to play a short clip. And this is, you know, you know, Arthur, the Joaquin Phoenix character, the Joker character, shows up after he's invited on the show, and he's wearing, you know, Joker makeup and
his
clothes.
His full look.
The full look. And the producer of the show, the Fred DeCordova type, played by Marc Maron, is, like, horrified. And the Johnny Carson type, played by De Niro, is kind of like, oh, no, we can make this work. This could be fun. The audience will enjoy it. I think there's one more thing we need to set up. And, Todd, I'm going to let you do it and give away as much as you want to about why they're suspicious of him dressed as a clown.
Well, basically, that day, there happened to be a big protest planned at City Hall. So there's a lot of people dressed up as clowns in this Joker look, which was, of course, inspired by him early on, this description given of him from those initial subway killings. So you'll hear them reference, you'll hear Marc Maron reference this sort of protests that are going on in the city, and how somebody actually that day, not by Arthur, but was killed actually by a policeman in a confrontation.
So here's that scene between the host, De Niro, whose name is Murray, the producer, played by Marc Maron, and Joaquin Phoenix as Arthur, Joker.
What's with the face? I mean, are you part of the protest?
No. No, I don't believe in any of that. I don't believe in anything. I just thought I'd be good for my act.
For your act? Didn't you hear what happened on the subway? Some clown got killed.
He's aware of that, yeah.
No, I hadn't heard.
Yeah.
You see, this is what I'm telling you. The audience is going to go crazy if you put this guy on. I mean, maybe for a bit, but not a whole segment.
Gee, it's going to work. It's going to work. We're going to go with it.
Thank you, Murray.
A couple of rules, though. No cursing, no off-color material. We do a clean show, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You go on right after Dr. Sally.
I love Dr. Sally.
Good. Well, someone will come and get you, okay?
Perfect.
Good luck.
Thanks, Murray.
Good.
Murray, one small thing.
Yeah.
When you bring me out, can you introduce me as Joker?
What's wrong with your real name?
That's what you called me on the show, a Joker. Do you remember?
Did I? I don't know. Well, if you say so, kid, you know, Joker it is. It's good.
Thanks, Murray.
Okay, so that's a scene from Joker. My guess is the director and co-writer, Todd Phillips. What was it like to direct both De Niro and Phoenix, Joaquin Phoenix, together? Were they both able to arrive at the place they needed to be in terms of getting the character in the same way at the same time? You know, like some actors like to take a lot of takes. Some actors go to extremes to get in roles. Both Phoenix and De Niro have either lost or gained a lot of weight for roles. I mean, they both get very deep into the characters they're playing. But did they sync up?
Yeah, I mean, as much as you want Murray and Arthur to sync up, I mean, they didn't really have to be in sync. That scene is one giant cringe, really, like, and so that you don't necessarily want them to be in lockstep with each other. But yeah, it's amazing to witness somebody like De Niro's approach as opposed to somebody like Joaquin's approach just in general. But again, I've seen that before with actors, just not with Robert De Niro, which was just mind-blowing to me.
Could you describe anything about those approaches without violating their confidence?
I mean, you know, Joaquin has a lot of questions and really likes to go really deep on stuff. I jokingly have said this about Joaquin to his face, so I could say it now. I say Joaquin is the tunnel at the end of the light. Just when you think, you know, you've cracked it, there's a whole nother layer to kind of peel back. And De Niro, at least, again, I can only speak with my experience on this movie with these two characters, much more matter of fact about it, kind of gets it on the first bounce, understands who Murray is, you know, and where Murray comes from. And okay, he's been on the air for 30 years. It's just two different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I just want to preface that by saying or say that I think that's how Joaquin is on this movie. I don't know that he's like that on every movie. It's what he needed for this character.
You create some real mayhem in Joker. And again, without giving away too much, but I know a lot of our listeners have already seen it, Joker has become, he's taken some vigilante action early in the film and become something of like a hero to a lot of people who are feeling like angry and resentful and disenfranchised and out of work and, you know, and they just kind of have a demonstration and erupt. And there's a lot of mayhem. Can you talk a little bit about creating both the story part of that and then actually literally creating it on set?
The movie was primarily shot in New York, in and around New York City, the Bronx, Brooklyn, areas that have yet to be totally gentrified, although I'm sure it's coming. Where we shot the mayhem that you're talking about at the end, the very end, was Newark, New Jersey, on a street called Market Street. There's like a great 5-block stretch in Newark where we were able to take over, and Mark Friedberg, our production designer, were really able to build out what the city would have looked like in, let's say again, 1981, and bring in 500 extras and dress them in clown masks and makeup and others and different things, and just you know, almost approach it like a war movie. Okay, you people over here, this is the crew that's going to break windows, and this crew over here is going to have fire, and this, you know, and you kind of with the stunt coordinators and with your AD department, your assistant directors, we just created this mayhem. I mean, it's fun to do. We shot nights in Newark, probably three nights, freezing nights over the course of that. It's definitely a fun thing to create, but it's also scary because you have 500 people going crazy and you want everybody to be safe and there's fire around and cars flipping and, you know, things happening. But it's an electric feeling to shoot it. I imagine it's almost like shooting a war movie or something.
So before I'd seen Joker, which again, I want to mention I liked a lot, just to be clear on the direction from which my questions are coming, I'd already heard reports about, like, is it too violent? Will it cause violence? And so the trailers I saw before Joker were trailers like for movies like action movies with a lot of CGI. So I remember like one scene where somebody's basically run over by like, it's either a tank or some kind of like large futuristic iron vehicle. And after being run over, it gets up and starts running away. And I thought, like, this is absurd. Like, mm-hmm. There are so many movies like this in movie theaters now where people just can take any kind of violence and still survive. And it's so unrealistic that why would a realistic depiction of the consequences of violence be the movie that presents the problem?
I know. It shocked us as well. And, you know, when we came out in a summer after, you know, another Rambo movie or John Wick film. And again, I think these films can exist, should exist. People, there's an audience for them. But you talk about celebrating violence and Joker is what Joker was guilty of is presenting real world implications to that violence. And to us, and maybe this was short-sighted, that felt like such a more responsible way of dealing with violence. I think in the end of the by the end of the movie, seven people die in our film. All people that did him wrong. Nobody random dies. He doesn't shoot any. You know, in his head, people who screwed him over. Whether he's right or wrong, that's another question. But he's not killing people randomly. It's not, you know, large level mass killings. This is a guy, I mean, this is essentially, you know, you talk about the movie being inspired by Taxi Driver, but really we were inspired by a time of films. And I would say there's as much Death Wish in this film. It's a revenge film as much as Taxi Driver, King of Comedy, Network, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, all these movies that inspired us. But anyway, it just felt really surprising to us when we started getting attacked for it being too violent. When you're like, wait a minute.
Joaquin Phoenix lost over 50 pounds for this role, like he kind of did in The Master. And when his shirt is off, he looks so undernourished. And you imagine he's like emotionally undernourished and spiritually undernourished, that he's undernourished in every way, like his bones jutting out. It's kind of like a metaphor for his whole existence. How did you feel watching him lose that much weight? It's not a healthy thing to do. I understand his desire to do it for the role, and it really is, it's very disturbing to see. It's very effective in the movie. But were you worried about his health when he was doing it, and did you feel very responsible?
Okay, so first I should say he did not have any desire to do it. That was something I asked him to do.
Oh, really?
He came to me early. In the script, it was written, you know, that Arthur is, I don't know if we use these words, but malnourished and wolf-like in his appearance, you know, or coyote, I don't remember. But it was always really important to me that he was bone skinny. Joaquin came to me early on in those initial meetings when we were talking about doing the movie and said, you know, what do you think if it's the opposite? What do you think if he's sort of like heavy Joker, like, you know, just kind of, because, you know, he's on all these medications and sometimes the side effects of medications is you gain weight. And I said, no, I really think he needs to sort of look hungry all the time, or as you said, just malnourished. And he was bummed because he knew how hard it was, because like you said, he'd done that before in The Master. He lost a bunch of weight. I was only concerned because he put it off for so long. He didn't really start losing weight until I think May or June, and we started shooting in September. And I kept saying, when do you start doing it? He's like, don't worry, I know how to do this. I've done it before. And so I was only concerned with the speed at which he did it, which really, he lost 52 pounds in 3 months, I think. And now I will also say, he had to lose 20, meaning even Joaquin would say he was 20 pounds overweight at that time for him. So you know, the 20 were like, okay, good, now he's back to how he normally is. But then to lose those 30 was no joke.
Todd Phillips, thank you so much. It's really been great to have you back on the show. And congratulations on the success of the film. I mean, people are very passionate. People are divided about it. But it's provoked a lot of really interesting conversations. And it's a great piece of filmmaking.
It has definitely struck a nerve. And I really appreciate you having me on, Terry. It's a thrill.
Todd Phillips speaking with Terry Gross in January. He produced, directed, and co-wrote the film Joker, which is nominated for 11 Oscars. The Academy Awards ceremony is Sunday. Coming up, we remember actor Kirk Douglas, who died Wednesday at the age of 103. Also, Justin Chang reviews the new Russian movie Beanpole. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Women in America have long vied for the highest political office, the presidency. This week on Throughline, how things have changed, and not, for female presidential candidates throughout American history. Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time to understand the present.
Kirk Douglas, a leading man in Hollywood in the 1950s and 60s, died Wednesday at his home in Beverly Hills. He was 103 years old. Douglas was known for his muscular good looks and a voice that often broke with emotion in dramatic scenes. He grew up in poverty, the son of poor, illiterate Jewish immigrants. He started acting in college, changed his name, and got into movies after serving in the Navy in World War II. He would eventually make more than 70 films, winning 3 Oscar nominations for Best Actor, but never capturing the prize. In 1996, he accepted a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Academy Awards ceremony after coming back from a debilitating stroke. His son is the actor Michael Douglas. Here's a sampling of some of Kirk Douglas's memorable performances. He was a trumpet player in the 1950 film Young Man with a Horn.
What a dope I was. I thought you were class, like a real high note you hit once in a lifetime. That's because I couldn't understand what you were saying half the time. Why, you're like those carnival joints I used to work in. Big flash on the outside, but on the inside, nothing but filth.
He played the leader of a slave revolt against the Roman Empire in the 1960 spectacle Spartacus.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
We can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators.
In Lust for Life in 1956, Kirk Douglas was the artist Vincent van Gogh.
I want nothing but to work. Only I can't. I'm in a cage of shame and self-doubt and failure. Somebody, believe me, I'm caged, I'm alone, I'm frightened.
And in 1951, he was a cynical, disgraced reporter in Ace in the Hole.
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog.
And a year after that role, Douglas played an unprincipled Hollywood producer in the 1952 film The Bad and the Beautiful.
Well, congratulations. You've got it. All laid out for you so you can wallow in pity for yourself. The betrayed woman. The wounded doe with all the dribble that goes with it going through your mind right now. Oh, he doesn't love me at all. He was lying. All those lovely moments, those tender words. He's lying. He's cheap and cruel. That low woman, Lila. Well, maybe I like Lilas. Maybe I like to be cheap once in a while. Maybe everybody does. Or don't you remember?
Terry spoke to Kirk Douglas in 1988 after his autobiography, The Ragman's Son, was published.
You started off in your first movie playing someone who was pretty weak in the film The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, and you went on to become a character who was seen as very strong. In fact, you mentioned that Ilya Kazan refers to you in his autobiography, and I'd like to read one of the things that he says when he was making the film The Arrangement, based on his best-selling novel. You wanted to be in the film. And he cast you in it, although he says there was something about the role that he thought Marlon Brando would have been better for. And Ilya Kazan writes, there was one problem with Kirk. Eddie, the character, has to start defeated in every personal way. The film rests on how basic and painful his initial despair is. Kirk has developed a professional front, a man who can overcome any obstacle. He radiates indomitability. Marlon, on the other hand, with all his success and fame, was still unsure of his worth and of himself. Acting had little to do with it. It was all a matter of personality. Did you ever think of yourself that way, as just radiating indomitability and that affecting the kind of roles that you could or cannot do well?
Working with Kazan in the arrangement was a wonderful experience. He's a great director. But I disagree with him completely. When I did Lust for Life, which I consider one of the most intriguing roles that I've played, I played a man completely unsure of himself. As a matter of fact, I sometimes tell my fellow actors that no one can play weakness better than I, starting with the very first movie that I did, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. And then when you go to a character like Lust for Life, I remember the first time we showed that, and I described this incident in my book where John Wayne was drinking at a party after a showing. He was very annoyed. He motioned me, brought me out on the balcony and said, he was very annoyed. He said, Kirk, how can you play such a sniveling, weak character? And I said, well, John, I said, well, you know, I'm an actor. It was an interesting role. I wanted to play it. No, no, he said, Kirk, we've got to play tough, macho guys. And he was really upset that I would be playing such a weak character. And you just read me a section where Kazan says that I just have that indomitable spirit. He must have been carried away by some other movie, because if you look at Lust for Life, the pathetic, you know, tragic aspects of a man who really didn't know what he was, who couldn't sell a painting, who wasn't sure that he was he a homosexual? He didn't know quite what he was. And those were the facets of the character that excited me. Although most people, I think of me, the last movie I did with Burt Lancaster was called Tough Guys, as sort of a tough guy. But I love to play parts, or try to find parts, with different dimensions. You see, Terry, if I play a strong man in a film, I look for the moments where he's weak. And if I play a weak character, I look for the moments where he's strong, because that's what drama's all about, chiaroscuro, light and shade.
Mm-hmm. You were one of the first actors to actually start their own production studio. You produced Lust for Life, which you were just talking about. You produced Spartacus.
No, you didn't produce that? I thought you did. I wanted to produce Lust for Life. I've produced Spartacus, Vikings, mm-hmm. Paths of Glory, Lonely mm-hmm. Other Brave. I wanted to produce Lust for Life, and I went to buy it and found MGM said, we own it. And I said, oh, I want to play that part. And I ended up playing the part with Vincent Minnelli, but I didn't produce it, no.
Why did you want to start your own production company? Did you feel like you didn't have enough freedom as an actor?
You know, because that was a very unique thing at that time. But I wanted a production company so that I could find something that I wanted to do and then try to develop it. And sometimes I was very successful at doing that, Spartacus, Paths of Glory. But sometimes I was very unsuccessful, as when I bought One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and had it for 10 years. And shopped it all over town, and nobody wanted to do it until my son Michael said, look, Dad, let's be partners. Let me see if I can get the money. And he went outside of the industry and got the money, and the rest is history.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the film Spartacus, in which you both starred and produced. You had starred in The Vikings, and you write in your new autobiography, The Ragman's Son, that after starring in The Vikings, you thought, that's it, no more epics for me. And then you go and turn around and actually produce one of the real big epics, Spartacus. Why did you want to make an epic?
Well, I didn't want to make an epic. And one of the first things I said to my group, I said, look, if we do this picture, Spartacus, let's make it as if it were a small picture. And to me, if you look at Spartacus again, you will find that the characters dominate the background. Most pictures, Ben-Hur and all that, the background is so enormous. But in Spartacus, Olivier, Lawton, Ustinov, Gene Simmons, the characters are stronger than the background. And that's what I try to do. In spite of the fact that it was an epic picture, I wanted the characters to be for them to be larger than life.
You mentioned the characters and some of the actors. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British, and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie, and I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple... For example, when I did the Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech, so that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great, great stage actors, great British stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian. You, Jewish, Tony Curtis, Italian. No, Tony Curtis is Jewish too, actually, isn't
that's
he?
That's right.
That's right. I always forget that.
But it doesn't matter. You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played when it's done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended it to
be. So the slaves have the rough quality, and that's the Romans right. have the more genteel, educated, refined
exactly.
sound.
And of course, Spartacus, you picked on a picture that plays is a big section in my book, because so much happened during the making of Spartacus. The most historical event was the breaking of the blacklist. And that's one of the reasons that Spartacus is so important to me.
Well, that's right. Well, Dalton Trumbo was writing it under a pseudonym, like he was writing all of his screenplays at the time, because he was blacklisted. And you insisted that for this movie he actually use his real name. Did you think that the time was right where you could say, this is Dalton Trumbo who wrote the movie, and where it would actually be accepted, that the time was right to break the blacklisting and have it be accepted, at least in part of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure. I did it rather impulsively. I don't think I was aware until a couple years later, as I reflected upon it, and like, you know, as I explain in my book, I began to see, you know, the significance of it. What bothered me when I did Spartacus was the hypocrisy in Hollywood, that these people, some of them who spent a year in jail for a crime that was never very clearly stated, I mean, were denied denied using their talents, except behind the scenes. Studio heads would look the other way while a lot of these unfriendly 10 writers would be writing scripts for very little money. So it was so hypocritical that it annoyed me to the extent that I said, well, what happens? We had a discussion of whose name are we going to put on the screen of Spartacus. And suddenly I said, well, what happens if I put Dalton Trumbo's name on? And they said, oh, Kirk, you're bound. They said, you know, oh, you're going to get out of the business and all that. I said, no, the hell with it. I'm going to do it. And the next day I left the pass. Dalton Trumbo hadn't been on a set in 10 years. I left the pass for Dalton Trumbo. No Sam Jackson. Of course, even Sam Jackson, we wouldn't have allowed on the set. Somebody might have recognized him as Dalton Trumbo.
That was his pen name for this movie.
Yes, and from then on, I mean, I'll never forget when Dalton Trumbo walked on the set, came over to me and says, Kirk, thanks for giving me back my name. There were people who, I got letters from different organizations, had a hopper attack me, but the sky didn't fall in. And after that, a few months after that, Otto Preminger announced that Dalton Trumbo was going to be writing this script, and the blacklist was broken.
Kirk Douglas speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1988. Douglas died Wednesday at the age of 103. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
It's Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Listen now, and we might even help you dominate your Oscars pool.
This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to the interview Terry Gross recorded with actor Kirk Douglas in 1988. Douglas died Wednesday at the age of 103. When we left off, they were talking about Douglas' starring role in the historical epic Spartacus.
Let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped
from slavery. After they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
We can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators. There's never been an army like that. One gladiator's worth any two Roman soldiers that ever lived.
We beat the Roman guards here, but a Roman army's a different thing. They fight different than we do, too.
We can beat anything they send against us if we really want to.
It takes a big army for that, Spartacus.
We'll have a big army. Once we're on the march, we'll free every slave in every town and village. Can anybody get a bigger army than that?
That's right. Once we cross the Alps, we're safe.
Nobody can cross the Alps. Every pass is defended by its own legion.
There's only one way to get out of this country. The sea.
What good is the sea if you have no ships?
The Cilician pirates have ships. They're at war with Rome. Every Roman galley that sails out of Brundusium pays tribute to them.
They've got the biggest fleet in the world. I was a galley slave with them. Give them enough gold and they'll take you anywhere.
We haven't got enough gold.
Take every Roman we capture and warm his back a little. We'll have gold all right.
Spartacus is right. Let's hire these pirates and march straight to Brundusium.
Well, they get their army, and you, as Spartacus, lead them against the Roman army. I think the battle scene in Spartacus, where the slave army and the Roman army fight, is one of the most interestingly choreographed movie battle scenes. The slaves are massed in almost a checkerboard formation. There are people in the slave and the Roman army as far as you can see. It is this huge vista of people. I'm wondering what your most vivid memory of being in the middle of all of that is.
Well, you see, all of that was historically accurate. We studied how Romans fought and how they arranged their armies. We shot the entire picture in the United States, except for those scenes which we shot in Spain, because you needed so many people, and we used lots of Spanish soldiers. The battle scenes were all shot in Spain because it needed thousands of people.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. The body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
You quote your wife in your book, who once said to you, it's an unnatural life just being wrapped up in make-believe characters. You've played so many different characters through the course of your career. Were you ever confused about who you really were as opposed to who the characters you played were?
Well, the only time I encountered something similar to that was in playing Lust for Life. Van Gogh really was a painful character to play. And shooting the picture, we shot it in Auvers-sur-Oise and Arles, Les Baux, all the places that Van Gogh lived. And when I came to the town of Auvers-sur-Oise, where Van Gogh died, and I had this stubby red beard and kinky red hair in the outfit, a lot of the old-timers, they actually felt as if Van Gogh had come back. So there was an amazing resemblance that I must have had to Van Gogh, and that all affected me. And the poignancy of that role did really get to me. I never watched Lust for Life until about 6 months after it was finished. I just didn't want to even be close to it. It was a painful experience.
People think of you, they think of your voice. Physically, they really think of the dimple in your chin. And when you started acting, was there ever a time where that was seen as a disadvantage? Did anyone ever try to cover that up with makeup?
Oh, yeah. The first time I came to Hollywood, you know, and they're looking at this Broadway actor, there was talk of... And they did. They filled it up with putty.
Really?
It had to be an awful lot of putty because I don't have a dimple in my chin. I have a hole in my chin. And it annoyed me. I said, look, I just pushed the putty out. I said, look, this is what you get if you want it. I'm not going to change it. So let me know if this is what you want or I'm going back to New York. And that was the end. I mean, and since then, I've never, you know, it's a part of me.
So you never let them actually shoot you with the putty in your chin?
No, because if I wanted to play... Oh, I would do that if there was a real reason where I wanted someone to have like a big lantern jaw and covering up this dimple in my chin would give me that effect. I would do it if the reason was to play a certain character or it's covered up when you have a beard. I mean, I do whatever I feel you have to do to play the character, not for, you know, vanity's sake. I am what I am. I can't change that.
Kirk Douglas speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1988. Douglas died Wednesday at the age of 103. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new Russian movie Beanpole. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
Film critic Justin Chang has a review of the new Russian movie Beanpole, which he says is one of the most exciting discoveries he made at last year's Cannes Film Festival. The movie won a prize at Cannes for its 28-year-old director, Kadamir Balagov, and was shortlisted for an Oscar for Best International Feature. It's set in Leningrad shortly after World War II. Here's Justin.
One of the first things you hear in Beanpole is the sound of a woman gasping for air. Her name is Ia, and as she comes into view, we see that she is staring into space, experiencing something between a seizure and a fugue state. She has these episodes every so often. Her body freezes up for minutes at a time, immobilizing her and making it difficult for her to breathe. It's an apt metaphor for this bleak and beautifully acted drama, which takes place in Leningrad in 1945, a moment when the shell-shocked Russian populace is struggling to catch its collective breath. Ia, brilliantly played by Victoria Miroshnichenko, is the 6-foot-tall beanpole of the title. But although she's physically imposing, she's a quiet, recessive presence, speaking rarely and with her eyes almost always cast downward. We learn that she was briefly stationed with the Red Army. It's not entirely clear what her role was, until she was diagnosed with post-concussion syndrome and discharged. Now she works as a nurse, dutifully tending to wounded vets, and coming to life only in the presence of her young son, Pashka. Early on, Ia brings Pashka to her hospital ward, where the soldiers, engaging the boy in a game of charades, ask him to imitate a dog. But as one of them points out, Pashka couldn't possibly know what a dog looks like. They were all eaten during the war. Not long afterward, something unbearably awful happens, the latest blow of many that Ia has to absorb. Beanpole, directed with extraordinary intimacy by the gifted 28-year-old filmmaker Kantemir Balagov, is about how the trauma of war lingers and seeps into everyday life, even after the war itself has technically ended. The story really gets going when Ia's army pal Masha, played by an excellent Vaisalisa Paralagina, returns home from the front lines. The two women couldn't be more different, and not just because Ia towers over Masha physically. Where Ia is shy and withdrawn, Masha is fierce and determined, her dark eyes blazing with mischief. Yet you can tell by the strange, semi-crazed smile that sometimes crosses her features that she, too, has been deeply scarred by her own wartime experience. Masha tries to pick up the pieces of her life, landing a job alongside Ia at the hospital and beginning a flirtation with a quickly smitten young man named Sasha. But the true focus of the story is her friendship with Ia. These two went through hell together during the war, and for better or worse, it has forged an unbreakable bond between them. Beanpole is about the secrets they share, and the feelings of guilt, confusion, and jealousy that ricochet between them as they try to move forward. It's still somewhat rare to see a war movie that focuses not on the heat of battle, but on the difficult, grueling aftermath. It's rarer still to see one this attuned to the emotional and psychological dynamics between women. But Beanpole is exceptional in every way. This is only the second feature directed by Bologov, who wrote the script with Alexander Terehov, and was inspired by Svetlana Alexievich's 2017 book, The Unwomanly Face of War. Bologov works in a deliberately paced, dramatically spare style that admirers of Andrei Tarkovsky, Alexander Sokurov, and other purveyors of austere Russian art cinema will immediately recognize. He's also a master of texture and atmosphere. You can see the horror and hopelessness etched in the anonymous faces of the men and women in the background, the ones who move alongside Ia and Masha at the hospital, or silently line up to board a streetcar in the public square. But for all the suffering he shows us, Bologov also has a remarkably beautiful eye. He brings a warm, painterly sense of color to the rundown apartment that the women share, and he dresses the actresses in the same bright, Christmassy shades of red and green that we see in the peeling wallpaper. It's hard to explain how a movie this tough to watch at times could also be so strikingly lovely to look at. But I think Bologov is attempting something both difficult and profound, and it comes into focus in a final scene that, for all its sadness, is also tentatively hopeful. He shows us that the friendship and love between these two women, even when it leads them to commit desperate, self-destructive acts, can be a life-sustaining force. Without sentimentalizing his characters or their circumstances, he shows us that the devastation of war can be a beginning as well as an end.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. On Monday's show, our guest will be Michael Pollan, who's written best-selling books about the origins of the food we eat and how psychedelics are helping scientists understand consciousness and the brain. He has a new audiobook about caffeine, its effect on the mind and body. As usual, he immersed himself in his research, quitting coffee cold turkey. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.